Greetings to everyone, and thanks so much for joining us. We're standing here on the corner of Wall Street and Main Street. We'll be speaking with some of the top minds and biggest names from both worlds. I'm your host, Douglas Blake, and this is the Wall & Main Podcast.
Greetings, and welcome to the Wall & Main Podcast. I'm Douglas Blake. Thanks for joining us today for what is, without a doubt, the most excited I've ever been to introduce a guest. We're speaking today with an absolute legend, Major League Baseball icon, number one overall pick in 1980, National League Rookie of the Year in 1983, four-time champion, nine-time All-Star, the one and only Daryl Strawberry. Daryl, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, I'll reveal my age. I'm 45 years old, and I grew up on Long Island in New York. So you probably know what this conversation means to me. and I said to our producers that as far as our demographic, the financial professional podcast listener, this is right down the fairway. I think a lot of people can relate to the excitement that I'm feeling in having the opportunity to speak with you today.
Well, like I said before, I've really appreciated you having me on and being able to have this conversation. And of course, you're 45, so you're still a baby. You know, I'm 61 now, I guess. My age is getting up there, but you did get a chance to see probably one of the greatest teams ever, you know, late 1986 Mets. I'm quite sure you were a part of that, watching that and seeing that growing up and how exciting that was for the city of New York.
My goodness, what an understatement. But you know, let's talk about two of the greatest teams, because I'm actually technically a Yankee fan, although everyone was a Mets fan in 86. And so the 86 Mets, and how about the 96 Yankees? So
yes.
can't forget about that team. That was a pretty good ball club as well.
No doubt about it. The 96 Yankees were a great team. The 98 Yankees were a great team. The 99 Yankees were a great team. So yeah, I had opportunity to play in New York for a long time and experience great success in New York City.
Yeah, so we'll get there, but let's go all the way back to the beginning. I want to really take care of this conversation because there's so much to discuss. It's such an incredible story. And I think it really, well, it starts in the 1970s, really, I think, in your formative years in South Central Los Angeles. What was the experience like growing up in that environment?
It was really great. Of course, I grew up in a broken home. I didn't have a father, a male figure in the house. So my mother raised five of us by herself. So that really allowed me to learn how to figure out life on my own. And because mom couldn't be at every place, she had to work to take care of kids. So it was challenging, but it was fun, I think, because I grew up with a lot of different coaches around my life that really helped me get to where I needed to get far as being in school and being in sports and playing all kinds of sports, even basketball. Basketball was very exciting in high school. I had a chance to go to college to play basketball, but baseball was my favorite. So I stuck with baseball, and it turned out to be the place that I would end up going to play in the city of New York after being drafted by the Mets in 1980.
How did you pick, of those sports, baseball? And did you have some players that you idolized or kind of looked up to growing up?
Yeah, I picked baseball because I grew up in California and I was a big Dodger fan. You know, when you grow up in California, that's what you watch is the Dodgers. Watching them, but I used to watch the Dodgers play the Cincinnati Reds back in those days. And Cincinnati Reds was a really popular team. With all the players they had, Johnny Bench, Tony Perez, you know, Foster, all those guys. And of course, Pete Rose was on that team. And I saw Charlie Hustle play. And I realized from there that I wanted to play baseball because Pete Rose wasn't like Joe Morgan or Johnny Bench, you know, with the home runs and the way they play. But he outplayed everybody because the way he hustled and the way his uniform was, it was dirty. And the baseball player uniform is supposed to be dirty. So that's where I realized I wanted to play baseball. Watching him growing up and watching Dave Parker playing for the Pittsburgh Pirates, was a right fielder, left-hander, and that could hit and hit for power and run. And I thought I could be like Dave Parker also too.
That's really a great observation. Pete Rose, you know, nobody played the game the way he did. And obviously, you know, his legacy is challenging. But if you go back to his playing days and think about the head first slides into first base and just the way that every inch he fought tooth and nail for it, very inspirational. And I could see why, you know, that would have been an interesting figure for you. But I'm looking through the stat sheets and, you know, I had such a blast doing research for this conversation. One number that I kept coming back to was 6'6", 190. I mean, I'm 5'10", just about 190. How do you, and you were muscular, but man, so lean, 6'6", 190, you know, the power and the speed that you brought to Major League Baseball was unlike anything I think that anyone had ever seen before. And so I guess maybe Pete Rose would be a good comparison. Although a lot of people compared you to Ted Williams.
Yeah, a lot of people did compare me to Ted Williams. I had no idea who Ted Williams was when I was in high school. And like he, the next Ted Williams, long and lean, could swing a bat. And, you know, I looked at Pete Rose and I saw Charlie Hustle and I saw him play hard. And I thought that's what a baseball player is supposed to be like. He's supposed to play hard, play the game and have fun. And I saw fun come out of him when he played the game. When he took a base on ball, he sprinted down first base and, of course, you know, he should have been a long time ago in the Hall of Fame, if my opinion, but that's just my opinion. So,
I'll say, you know, I saw an interview that you did when you were at Crenshaw High School as part of the process of doing research for this conversation. And, you know, you kind of seemed as surprised as anyone when all of the major league scouts were showing up at your baseball field watching you play. Can you describe the feeling you had, or maybe the experience of learning that you were the number one overall draft pick in 1980?
Yeah, it was kind of funny, you know, to me, you know, going out for baseball after the basketball season was over because we had won the city championship and we went up to Oakland to play in the tournament of champions up there, and we lost in the first round. So the next day I was back, and I was back in the baseball uniform, and it was one day of practice, and the season was getting ready to kick off. And there it was, you know, my first game going out there, and it's like 50 scouts out there, and I was just kind of, you know, I was kind of shocked to see so many. I think in my junior year, four players had got drafted, and they kept asking the coach about me, and he said to them that he's a junior and he's going to be back next year. And they couldn't believe that I was a junior. They thought I was a senior that year. And my senior year there, I was coming out to play baseball. And here it is, all these major league scouts talking about this kid is going to be great. And he's going to be the next Ted William. And he's going to do some great things at the major league level. Of course, being 6'6 and 190 and can run and throw and swing the bat like I was able to swing the bat. It worked out well. It didn't start off that way. I mean, I got off to a really rough start because I hadn't had any practice in baseball. So it was really challenging my senior year until I really got going. And then I started really putting the bat on the ball and playing real well that senior year. And the prediction was I was going to be in the top three picks.
I think your swing might be the most iconic swing in all of baseball. I can't think of another. The bat seems to travel about a half a mile in a split second, the way that, and that high leg kick. I mean, you probably ruined my little league career because, you know, as a 5'10 right-hander, I had no business trying to emulate that swing, but I did anyway, because, you know, if I had a chance to pretend to be Darryl Strawberry in context, you knew I was going to. But, you know, talk about culture shock. We started out this conversation talking about the diverse background in which you grew up in South Central Los Angeles. And, you know, these days, if you're the first overall pick in any sport, you know, your Rolls Royce is waiting for you to take you to your private jet, sign your 9-figure contract. You got a plane ticket to Kingsport, Lynchburg, and Jackson in the deep South to play minor league baseball. What was that culture shock like for you? What was that experience like for you? And what challenges and maybe opportunities did that present?
Yeah, I think the first year going to Kingsport, Tennessee was a culture shock. And the experience that I was getting was like, wow, I wanted to go back home. And I was calling my mother every night saying, wow, this is different than I thought it would be. I didn't know what exactly it would be like getting into professional sports. But I realized right away it was going to be very challenging. It was not going to be easy. And coming from, South Central Los Angeles and going into Kingsport, Tennessee, the middle of nowhere, and being just a light shining on me because I was supposed to be this great ball player. And there was a lot of conversations with fans and stuff and people saying, you're not going to make it. You're not going to be a great Major League Baseball player. You're overrated. So I thought, wow. I called my mother and I said, I want to come home. She goes, no, you decided this is what you want to do and you're going to have to stick it out. That was something I had to learn right away from my mom, that she was going to make me stick it out. She said, you made this decision that this is what you wanted to do. So it's a challenge there and you're not going to quit and you're not going to give up. So I'm thankful for my mother always pushing me not to give up and not quit.
The 80s were a very raw, very different time than 2023. And I'd imagine it was more than just negative feedback that you got playing baseball in the deep South in that environment. I mean, can you speak to that adversity and what that must have felt like personally to have to deal with?
Yeah, it was really different, especially when I went to the next year and I went to Lynchburg, Virginia. And it was the deep South and I was called a lot of names. I can remember one guy up in the corner of the stadium just getting all over me, calling me boy and this and that, and you suck. And I just remember my manager, Gene Doucette. He was so good. And my manager, he was white. And he used to tell me, do not look up there. Because he thought to himself, if I looked up there, I probably would have ran up there with a bat and started eliminating people. And that wouldn't have been the thing to do. My career would have been over. So I was fortunate enough to be able to have him in my life to be like a father figure to show me that this is part of where you're at, where you're playing. It's a different place and they think different in these areas. And so I went through that process and I came close to quitting after that year. I had told the organization that I thought baseball was not for me. I thought I needed to go back to college. I probably tried to play basketball. And they asked me to give it another year. Think about it. And I said, I'll give it one more year. And I thought about it. And I went to Jackson, Mississippi the next year. And Gene Doucette was my manager again. And I just remember having a big brother in spring training called Lloyd McClendon, who was with me too. And he broke his hand in spring training. And he was going to be set back. And he wasn't going to start the season. And I went to Jackson. After Lynchburg, we had that. And then in Lynchburg, Lloyd McClendon was my big brother. So I come back the next year and I go to Jackson, Mississippi. And there was, I go on from there to win in that league, go in that league to have a great year, be MVP of that league in the team. And there was, I felt like I had arrived as a baseball player more than anything, because that season was a great season after spending in Jackson, Mississippi. And I fought through some things and then I went on from there to AAA the next year, 1983, and played 1 month in AAA. And before there, I was in the big leagues.
Something definitely clicked in 1982. 34 home runs, 45 stolen bases, and a .283 average. And that's in 129 games. I mean, that's you're paying your dues. And that's kind of what they made players do back then before they could, make it to the big show, as it's called. So this is where, we have a podcast called the Wall in Maine podcast. And so we're really trying to tell the story of Wall Street and the story of Main Street and how the two tie together. So I think maybe the most Wall Street aspect to playing baseball professionally is the experience that you had with money. So 1983, NL Rookie of the Year, obviously all of this momentum behind you, all of this buzz, this excitement, I'm imagining this is around the time you started really coming into money. What was your experience like with money before that? What was it like coming into that prosperity? And then over the course of your career, my research shows that you earned about $30 million. You know, it was a very different environment back then. The league, in my opinion, didn't really take care of their players. The financial advice and support that players have today, they simply didn't have back then. You know, what was the guidance that you received? Were you sort of made to fend for yourself? Can you just explain a little bit what you feel your experience was like, you know, handling that prosperity at that young age?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because it's very challenging because you don't really know a lot about money. I think coming out of high school like I was in 1980 and being the number one draft pick and signing for $200,000, I thought, wow, I really hit the lottery there, you know, compared to what it is now today. You know, it was sure. Big at that time. And I didn't know have a lot of experience about money because I didn't grow up with money. So money really was never like a big thing to me. I think I was more focused on the playing part and getting well, becoming great at what I was doing. And you learn about money as you go along. And I think coming into 1983, and this is probably a shock to a lot of people, but when I came to the big leagues, my contract was for $35,000. So 1983, and that's what I made as a rookie. And realizing that, you know, money was going to start being a part of it, because after that rookie season, I go on to win the National League Rookie of the Year. Then I signed a contract for like $7 million. And that was big, you know, for a 21-year-old to be able to sign a contract after his rookie season. And now you come into money and you start experiencing the life of doing whatever you want. I think when you're young, you think you can do everything. You think the money's going to last forever. You think it's going to be there forever. You're never going to get hurt or anything is ever going to happen. And you believe that the fact that you're going to make more, you're going to always keep making more. And realizing that that's not the case, it goes fast. You start thinking about buying things. You buy your mother a car. You buy your mother a house. You buy yourself a car, you buy yourself a house, and you got to pay taxes. And you don't realize the value of what money is at that time when you're young. You just believe that it's going to always be there. And if you don't take care of it and you don't put it away, it's going to go away. You're going to spend it, or you're going to have someone else spend it for you. That's just the way it was back then, and that was the reality of it. And they didn't have any schooling for that. They didn't send you anywhere to say, here's a place where you can educate yourself and learn about the dollar that you're making and what to do with the dollar that you're making. So you didn't have that when we was coming up in Major League Baseball.
Right. And it occurred to me, and looking at the career arc of a lot of professional athletes, you make such a large amount of your lifetime income in such a short period of time. It's critically important to manage that. But there's an aspect of immortality that you have, as you know, you are, I would say, in 1984, 85, 86, maybe one of the greatest athletes on the planet, certainly one of the best baseball players, probably the best hitter bar none in the sport. You know, during that period of time, it's hard not to feel immortal. And financial planning, wealth management is sort of about embracing your mortality, knowing this isn't going to last forever, that someday you'll wake up from this dream, and planning for that. But I'm sure in 1985, that's the last thing you want to do is you know, start thinking about the afterlife.
You make a good point there. You cannot think about that at 22 years old, 23 years old.
You don't want to wake up from the dream.
You don't want to wake up from the dream, and you want to stay focused on what you're doing. You want to believe that you're going to be a great player. Each year you want to get better. And really, that's where a young player focused more than anything. Back in those days, it was not like you were sitting around counting the fact that I have a contract and I'm not going to get another contract. You wasn't thinking about that. You're thinking, well, I'm under contract. I'm here with this team for at least the next 7 years, and I got to be here to play. That's a good thing. You had some type of stability there, so you felt comfortable with that. But are you really paying attention to the financial part? Not really. You're paying attention to the fact that I got to get better every year. I got to grow every year. I got to become a better player. And that was my main focus. And it happened so fast with me because of the fact we ended up going in a different direction as a team and organization for when I first came up. When I first came up, we were a team with a lot of veteran players who were on the end of their last run of playing. And I realized with them, it was a complete business for them. They were in it for what they were going to make and what they were going to take home and move on from playing because they were at the end of their careers. And then I spring into a new season where we become a younger team and younger players start to come up to the major leagues and we become an exciting team. Now, when you become an exciting team like we did after 84 and 85, now the expectations are there. The fans are there to support you and you become better at what you're doing as an athlete, not as a business person. And I think people don't recognize that there's a business side of it even more now because of the salaries are so big. So you have to pay attention to your financial part of who you are. But at the time, I wasn't paying attention to all that. I was paying attention to the fact that I need to get better. And to get better is going to help the team win. It's going to help us more successful. And those are the kind of things that I had to experience as I was coming along at the major league level at a young age. Because most people don't realize when we won a first championship in 1986, I was only 24 years old. So that tells you how young I was coming up and having to learn.
There's not a story that hasn't been told about the 1986 Mets, but just kind of for context here, you know, New Yorkers, first of all, the New York media is a megaphone. So anything you're going to do in sports, if you do it in New York, it becomes global news, if not national. And the 86 Mets really captured the imagination and the spirit, I think, of that tough, you know, 1980s New Yorker attitude. But also the Mets, you know, kind of like the legacy of betrayal of the New York baseball fan, where you had the Brooklyn Dodgers, they left like a thief in the night to LA. You had the New York Giants, they went to San Francisco. And yes, it's not lost on me that you were among, I believe, five players ever that played for all four legacy New York sports teams, the Mets, Yankees, Giants, and Dodgers. But when they left a real void until the Mets came along in 63. And all of the fans of the Dodgers and the Giants were sort of waiting because the last thing they were going to do was go and root for the Yankees. I remember Chris Rock famously saying that rooting for the Yankees to win the World Series is like rooting for Bill Gates to win the lottery.
Well, that's the history of New York City. Yankee fans and Mets fans, you know, they do not like each other. They do not believe in each other whatsoever. If you're a Yankee fan, you're a Yankee fan. You're a Mets fan, you stay over on that side. And of course, I had opportunity to play for all the New York teams.
The fact that you brought a championship to both and actually three to my beloved Yankees, I mean, you're definitely in the New York Hall of Fame already. But that 86 team, something about it, you know, it was just the right place, right time, and such a, you know, a tinderbox, so explosive. Rather than go through all the details of it, because like I said, you know, there's nothing that can be said at this point about the 86 Mets. I want to do a very quick word association with a couple of players, and I'd like to get sort of your feedback. We'll start with Mex, Keith Hernandez.
Quite the player, great leadership, brought tremendous experience to the younger players. He allowed us to stay focused on what was important and learning how to win.
Right. So we're not going to talk about picture day. So
yeah, that was next a good one.
Next one, Lenny Dykstra.
Lenny Dykstra, a guy that would gamble away every penny he had to be in the spotlight, but a guy that had the biggest heart that you can ever imagine to play at that level. And, you know, with the team having a bunch of stars, and then you have a guy like that that would fit in, that would become a big piece of the puzzle that would just bring excitement to the ballpark, to his style of play, of getting dirty.
Absolutely. And I can't can't count how many times I saw him crash into the outfield fence. He must have been in right, you know, like, what the heck's what's wrong with this guy? But he was very much a gopher broke kind of player, that's for sure.
He was. He definitely was.
All right. How about, this is an interesting one for me, Davey Johnson.
Davey Johnson was
the manager of the Mets in 86.
He was a player's manager. And the reason why I say that, him and Joe Torre was just alike. They had a great understanding about players and how to let players be players. And why do I say that? Because they both played at the highest level. And when you see their bubblegum card, you see the years that they had and the numbers that they put up. They understand the game of baseball and they understand the challenge of being an everyday player, that it's going to be some roller coaster rides, but they know how to ride with players. And what I like about Davey Johnson and Joe Torre, each one of them, they never throw their players under the bus through the media. And that was really important to be in this town playing and have a manager that he would take the heat over the players.
It's interesting. I can get fact-checked on this, but if I'm not mistaken, there's only two players in Major League history that have hit two pinch-hit grand slams, Darryl Strawberry and Davey Johnson.
Oh, really? I didn't know Davey Johnson hit two pinch-hit grand slams. He did, huh?
Apparently.
He was a fun guy to play for.
Yeah, well, but there was more to the story than that. I know there was a famous double switch in Game 6 of the 1986 World Series, that iconic game, you know, in Boston with Bill Buckner. But well, I digress, because again, you know, that story's been told. Gary Carter, the kid, number 8.
I would say he was the most incredible person on a team with a bunch of stars that cared the most about people than any other player. He cared about a person's life than being just a great baseball player. I never experienced that with a guy that cared about your own personal life and you being well instead of how well you doing on the baseball field. So that was really, really special to be able to have a guy like that around. That's when I really got to see what a real man is like, not just a baseball player, but a real man, you know, a man that cared about his family, cared about others, and also cared about winning. That was a big thing for him too. He brought great leadership and great experience behind the plate and to a pitching staff that needed him.
It's a fitting tribute. Really an incredible guy, taken from us way too early. And I remember, you know, a guy who loved and cared about his team, and you could see it. And in 86, when you went into Fenway, and, you know, back then, the American League, National League would only meet in the World Series. He didn't have that interleague play going on. And hearing this legend about the Green Monster,
right,
and thinking, how could a guy ever hit a ball over this, you know, massive wall? And Gary Carter does it. I think he does it first. And it was a feeling of, okay, we can slay this giant because
Gary that's Carter. That's the reason for getting back in that series, because of Gary Carter, big night over in Boston. Yeah.
So I got one more name on the 86 Mets that I want to use for word association. And we don't have to go this far down the road, but I'm sure you can imagine what name we haven't heard yet.
Go ahead.
Well, Doc.
There's only one, Doc Gooden.
Doc Gooden, Dwight Gooden. Your career and his career, the trajectory was so synchronized. It was almost supernatural. From completely different worlds, you know, coming together. And I noticed sort of the divergence in the notion that, you know, you had a very challenging upbringing and really the absence of your father, but the strength certainly of your mother, you know, carrying you through, but that shadow sort of cast over you. He had really the expectations, I think, and the pressure of his father, and that shadow cast over him. But you both arrived at this moment at such a young age to go on to have some of the greatest seasons together in baseball history and championships. And, you know, maybe just a very quick thought of what your relationship with Doc was like and maybe what it was like in 86 having that success together.
Well, Thank you for that. It was pretty incredible, you know, to be so young and talented like that at such a young age. For myself, I'm coming up in 83 and winning Rookie of the Year, and him coming right behind me in 84 and winning Rookie of the Year at the age of 19. I've never seen anyone as great as he was on the mound for those years, those early years in his career that we played together. I thought it was pretty boring being in the outfield and never getting any action because he just mows everybody down like it's nothing. And you're talking about major league hitters, you know, guys are very successful. That a kid could be that young, especially that 85 year, his Cy Young year, where he just dominated major league hitters. We come from different backgrounds, different places, you know, in our lives. I come from a place where I just had, I come from a dysfunctional family, like you said before, you know, with my father and who he was, the rejection of our life. And Doc comes from a different place with his mother and father there. But some of the same kind of situations, even with him having his father there growing up and seeing a lot of things that he saw when he was young, I think was very disturbing to him and had an effect on his life just as well as the things that I grew up around had the effect on my life. It made us great baseball players and experienced the life of playing baseball because we were driven to do that. But also at the same time, the brokenness on the inside was real for him and also for myself. And it would play out later in our life. Down the road somewhere, you know, the trouble would come because of not being well. And I think a lot of times people think, well, they should be well because they play Major League Baseball. And I tell people all the time, Major League Baseball does not make you well. It makes you a baseball player. And I think people have to realize that. And I had to realize that for myself. And I had to experience it firsthand for myself. And I'm glad that I was able to experience that and go through that and learn life. The life lessons that I've learned out of it, because either you can learn the lessons out of it or not. And I was able to, and, you know, Doc had a real, really challenging time, you know, facing life and dealing with life, just like I did. And, you know, I realized that it can happen to anybody, no matter how great you are as an athlete, it can happen to you. It doesn't mean that you have arrived because you are very successful in performing and on the field.
Absolutely. And, you know, now to kind of jump ahead, because that all of the ups and downs have been very well documented, you know, for better or worse in the media and in the New York media in particular, you know, there's really no escape. And so that's not really the story I think we need to tell here. But how about the story of redemption? Because, you know, in the challenging time that you had in your latter years in New York and a little bit of time in LA playing for the Dodgers, which should have been a homecoming, but apparently wasn't really the best thing for you at that time. Coming back and playing for the Yankees and playing for that 96 team and contributing there. What can you tell me about the 96 Yankees?
Well, I can tell you about the 96 Yankees. It was put together. It was put together well by the boss, George, more than anybody else, him and Gene Michaels, who was a person that saw players that can fit in and come and help this ball club probably get over the hill, top of the hill, because you have to be able to have a team that can be able to withstand the knockout punch sometime and be able to get back up, not get completely knocked out, you know, because you're going to get knocked down sometime, but not knocked out all the way. And I think that's what the team was built around, with Joe Torre being the manager and another type of manager that understood players. Joe looked down at his players, not only the players that he had on the field, but he always looked down on his bench and realized that I got players over here that can play and that have experienced very good success at the major league level. And at some point, you know, I need to use them. If you don't use them, then you might not be able to overcome some of those, you know, adversities that you have. And I think that's what was good about Joe Torre and realizing that. And he had players that he can use on his bench that would come and be a big plus to his team. So that 96 team was able to thrive because of that, because of the manager. If you don't have a manager that don't understand that and can't look down and see that I got players, you know, might be struggling on the field and I got players over here that has done it before that can help me, then that's a very difficult situation to be in. So Joe Torre was the kind of man fitted for that whole situation for the Yankees to be able to thrive and be able to move forward. And he did that every year that I played there for the Yankees. And he realized that he had players that can help him just as well as the starters. And I think when you don't have that and you don't understand that, your team probably is not going to be successful. And I think that's why we were so successful that year with the Yankees, because of the manager, Joe Torre, understanding what he had as a team.
So we were going to play some word association with the 96 Yankees, and you checked off the first two, Steinbrenner and Joe Torre. So two quick ones, Mariano Rivera.
Mariano was he was something special. You knew he was special in 96 because he was a setup man, and you realized that maybe the next year that he was probably going to be the closer, but he was set it up for it was at Wendland, I think. Yes, John. Yeah. And he was a setup man. So he would go on to be the all-time great. Was it a surprise? No, it wasn't a surprise to us because we saw that early in his career.
And then, of course, speaking of all-time greats, the captain, number two, Derek Jeter.
He's like nobody else. I mean, just the personality of who he was real. There was no, fakeness about him. He was just who he was. Never said a bad word about anybody. I just couldn't. I admired him for that. I admired him for the way he carried himself, the way he acted as a teammate. Everybody, he loved everybody, cared about everybody. He reminds me so much of what Carter was like, the same kind of caring for his teammates. Even if someone said something bad about him, he would turn the cheek and look the other way, and then he'd like let you slap him on the other cheek. He didn't care. He was not going to say anything bad about him.
So now to kind of bring it home, because I know we don't have all day. I could be here for a month firing off questions, and I'm sure you're nice enough to answer them for as long as you can. But, we do have to kind of keep this within some time frame. I want to talk a little bit about redemption. And let's start, first of all, three more rings. After all of the media hype and all the adversity in New York, really contributing to those teams. In fact, hitting 24 home runs in 98, clearly on your way back to being, that great player that we had seen earlier in the career. And then the cancer diagnosis and man, that I saw you in some research that I had done on this conversation. I saw you kind of break down there because it was like, I've been in control of my destiny for better or worse until this point. But now this is something that I have to battle against and it's out of my hands. And I could see the defeat, that you were feeling at that time. What was that experience like in dealing with that?
It was really hard, because I know for a young age to be able to have cancer at a young age like I did. I was really thinking back to my mom because she was 55 years old when she passed away from terminal breast cancer. So there was real fear there in my life at the time that here it is, I'm in my 30s and I got to deal with this. Am I going to make it? I have young kids. And just a whole lot of things that go through your head and you think about when you have to go through that process. And it was an uphill battle. I had to fight. It was a real challenge in my life. Probably the biggest challenge I had in my life was battling that twice and losing my left kidney in the second surgery and realizing that this is no joke. This is real life. Now, real adversities is here. We think we have them playing baseball, but real life situations are going to come against all of us at some point. And how do we deal with it? How do we handle it? How do we fight through it? So it was the biggest steps that I had to take and realizing that I had to take them. And it wasn't easy. It wasn't always an easy road to jump on and say, this is going to be easy. Nothing's easy about it, going through surgery and going through chemo. And I just remember the process of going through chemo sometimes. I just didn't want to do it anymore. I just laid in bed and said, I'd just rather die, and instead of having to fight this battle. And I just kept pushing and people kept, encouraging me, you got to get up, you got to do it for your kids. I remember the second time coming around having cancer reoccur again after being in a 5-year window and didn't make it through in 2000. That I remember the doctor telling me the fact that, this is not really about you. It's about your little kids. They need a chance to have their father live. So I was encouraged, you know, through that process and went through the second surgery, but I ended up losing my left kidney in that. So I've experienced some real challenges in life. I'm grateful for them, I can tell you that. You'll think about
kind
life
of like more. put a bookend on that. So I want to say, you know, Dwight Gooden, there's a great story about him pitching a no-hitter for the Yankees and his father from a hospital bed getting to watch that, you know, and actually that being the last time that he saw Dwight play baseball before passing away. And so after seeing so much of Dwight Gooden's adversity, at least he got the, you know, that sort of last note, you know, to see Dwight, even for that moment, back on top and sort of overcoming, even just for that moment, all of that adversity. And sort of to come back to the beginning of our conversation, I heard a really incredible story about you visiting your father and actually forgiving him.
Right. Yeah, that was something long overdue, I believe, for me that I couldn't get past for a very long time, because I was very bitter inside and I never released him. And I carried that for a long time. And it wasn't until I went to the hospital and asked him to forgive me for keeping him out of my life and my career and not allow him to know his grandkids. And we had a moment there where I did that, you know, because my life had changed, you know, and of course I've been in ministry a long time and I became a different person and going out helping the multitude of people. And there it was, God was using me to help my father in that situation and to be able to walk down that process while he was in the hospital and go through that forgiveness of extending it to him and him receiving Christ in his life was a big deal to me. It set me free for the rest of my life. I had never been in bondage again after doing that. And I think a lot of times we think the forgiveness is for the other person, but the forgiveness was actually for me so I can be well.
That it sounds like, and it must've been just a huge weight off of your shoulders. Probably something that even as hard as it was to do, maybe you wish you'd done even sooner.
Well, yeah, you do. And a lot of times we don't make that move as people. We still stay stubborn and we want to stay to ourselves and we want to believe that we have to be right. And I realized in the end, I didn't have to be right. I just needed to clear the picture of what our life was all about and try to move forward from that point. And I was able to do that. And I'm thankful that I was able to do that because it's, like I said, at the end of the day, it really brought freedom to me that I've never experienced before.
Absolutely. And I think one of the challenges you face and all of us face, I mean, the story of Darryl Strawberry is such sort of a human story. Because we can all relate to the triumph and the adversity in our own different ways. And we're all standing at a crossroads, you know, and we have gravitational forces pulling us towards pain or pulling us towards purpose. And, you know, usually the path that we choose is pretty clear by what's happening around us as a result of our decisions. But I know that now you've really chosen a path of purpose, which makes all of the adversity that you faced in the past really a blessing, because yeah, you can instruct and you can educate people on your journey in hopes that they'll make the right decisions, you know, with their challenging lives. Could you talk about kind of the purpose that you found in life post baseball?
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, it's pretty cool. I would never think in my wildest dream that I would be in ministry and traveling the country and encouraging people and helping people from where I came from with addiction, overcoming addiction, and helping people to find freedom in that, and just helping people to find freedom in life, and going into places that I could never think in my, like I said, that I would participate in, like going into a prison. Tomorrow I'm going into a prison in Pennsylvania, Maxwell Cutie's prison, to preach to guys there that are locked up and got life, and to be able to go into places like that to bring about encouragement, no matter how far down we go, you know, there's a time of looking up. And when we do look up, we find the peace and the freedom. And, you know, when we find our faith, adversities is a part of life. You don't have to sit there forever and think, you know, I belong there. I can stay there. You don't have to stay there. You can get up. And no matter what the circumstances have been in anyone's life, I'm a prime example. No matter how far down you go, you can always get up and you can always find yourself in a better place to have a voice, to have a bigger voice, to help a multitude of people. And I think that's what I've been called for, is to help the multitude of people. I travel this country 270 times out of the year, preaching and going into schools, helping kids not get to drugs, helping kids get off of drugs. So it's a lesson behind everything that we go through. It's just a matter of, do you see the lessons behind it? And I think sometimes a lot of people can't see it and they think, well, I'm a failure. I'm not a failure. I'm not a victim. I'm an overcomer.
I mean, on that note, there's not much more to say, but what I will say is that, you know, you gave us so much glory, so much hope, so much inspiration in the 80s and in the 90s, just watching your feats on the field. But your greatest triumph, your greatest achievements, I think you're actually living right now. And it's inspirational. It's unbelievable to think of what you've overcome and still standing and doing good in this world. And I know this is going to be a real treat for all the listeners of this podcast. And Darryl Strawberry, we cannot thank you enough for your time and your input here into what has just been a really meaningful and really incredible conversation.
Well, thank you guys. Thanks for taking time out of your day to have me on.
Ladies and gentlemen, the great Darryl Strawberry.